Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Hello there. Sorry about not distributing the podcast for the last few weeks. I've been on vacation in Morocco and got out just in the nick of time. This is the first live podcast since we got back. I do hope you enjoyed the genetics show I posted last week. Please email your questions by going to askdrdawn.com and using the Contact Us box. You can also make suggestions for topics. We are offering something new. We've decided to begin offering video conference visits to our audience. If you would like to take advantage of that, please go to askdrdawn.com and use the Contact Us box to make a request. And now, an all-COVID, all-the-time version of Ask Dr. Dawn. Oh, is it only a week ago? Yes, it's only a week ago. The morning after Trump's kind of surprise evening speech where he said he was shutting down returns from Europe. And of course, I was in Madrid and very thoroughly protected in terms of masks and gloves and sanitizer. But when I hit the airport, there was literally a line the entire length of the airport. We're talking easily 100 yards. Everyone thought they had to get home in the next 48 hours. Turns out, oops, nope, that wasn't quite the situation. Fortunately for me, I already had boarding passes and was able to bypass the line and keep my 6 feet precautions. I also was, everyone was kind of rolling their eyes watching me swab things down with hand sanitizer and Clorox wipes. But they're not laughing now. So, that being said, I am self-quarantining in the sense that I did not want to go into the station. They're doing a very good job with their masks, gloves, and sanitation. And I am using full protective gear if I see patients, and that means, unfortunately, that I cannot talk in a microphone. So here we are working from home. I hope the sound quality is okay. So the first thing I wanted to do was just reflect a little bit. As I said, Monday morning, I was in my car and I saw a rollover traffic accident at a time when I did not expect to visit patients. I was just going to the office to pick up supplies. And I looked at that very severe accident and thought to myself, that person's headed for the emergency room. That person's headed into probably into an ICU bed. And that's really part of what I wanted to just address. There's going to be, and always has been, a baseline barrage of stuff that happens that puts people in the hospital. Cases of appendicitis, car accidents, people falling off the ladder, heart attacks, traumatic head injuries, strokes. That baseline rate of stuff is going to keep happening. Now, I had several anecdotal stories from people in my family and in my immediate circle about individuals who were sort of standing up and saying, you know, I'm going to ignore this. This is crazy. I'm not going to let it affect my lifestyle. This is all fake news, whatever, whatever, whatever. And I think that's natural. I think denial is a very natural reaction. And I want to appeal to people who are not actually following the real restrictions, who are not staying in their home, who are not doing the 6 feet social distancing thing, because I want to appeal to your sense of patriotism. You're fine, you're young, you're not going to get sick, right? Well, you might just have a case of appendicitis. So this, you know, famous last words, I'll be okay.
We're all vulnerable at some level, whether it's from a truck rollover or a sudden injury of some other kind, or, you know, a fire and a burn. There's just so many things that can happen. And yeah, the odds are low, but right now we need to leave space for such things to occur. So the two lessons to take home here is that if you are mildly sick and you manage to infect someone else, and that person ends up in the hospital because they're older or sicker or more vulnerable than you, maybe on some sort of immunosuppression drug, and we'll come back to that in a moment, then you've hurt somebody. And, you know, staying home and being very prudent when you do venture out and doing it only when it's absolutely necessary, that's how you save somebody's life. And speaking as a doctor and a 30-year physician, I can tell you that saving another human being's life is one of the most amazing gifts that one ever gets. It gives you a sense of validation, I guess, is the most obvious word, and meaning. And you have a chance to do that. You have a chance to save a life just by being very careful about your behavior and not being cavalier and saying, well, I'll be fine because I'm young and I'll be cool. No, we all need to recognize that our behavior has ripples. And this is a moment where seemingly innocuous behaviors can have huge ripples. There's also another aspect to this that I want to discuss and reflect on, and that's the infrastructure issue. So by which I mean, there are a lot of firefighters out there. There's a lot of law enforcement people. They're going to be exposed, and many of them, hopefully not many, but some of them will get sick. And that's going to reduce the workforce for these important critical jobs that keep things going. And if you're like, well, you know, firefighters, they're supposed to be risking their lives, police officers, they signed up for that. How about electricians? Okay, how about the people who keep our electric grid going? What if there's another storm and the power lines are down? You want your power restored. You want the internet to keep working. If too many people get sick, everything starts to unravel. So we are all in this together. Whether you are willing to acknowledge it or not, rugged individualist, we are all connected. And we need to cooperate, and we need to protect each other at this moment. And, you know, that's the editorial for the day. Even the delivery and the warehouse people, the people who are home because they've been sent home or who have been laid off of their jobs, we need to figure out a way to get food and money so that they can pay their rent. And we need to have a real clear understanding of the implications of our behavior. I just got a question, what about Amazon employees? And when I talk about, yes, warehouse people and delivery people, supply side people, you know, there's a crash in the manufacturing and certainly the resupply once the warehouses are empty is going to be really slow. And no one can predict what that's going to look like. But we need to remember that when we make if we make an internet purchase, we are going to be loading the system. So you want to be prudent. You want to get what you need. But you don't want to corner the market on hand sanitizer in 3 states and then expect to sell it on Amazon for a lot of money so that you don't have to work next year. Not only is that highly unethical, but it also endangers you because, hey, there's no hand sanitizer around except in your garage. So what does that do to the odds that you're going to be exposed? Well, it certainly increases them. So let's all take a deep breath and behave ourselves. I now want to turn and talk about quality of information. There's obviously a lot of dubious information being circulated, and these are in ordinarily trustworthy circles. Things are things are being, the major journals are bringing stuff up very quickly. And those things are being peer-reviewed, but they're being peer-reviewed and fast-tracked. And we're all looking for answers. So the first thing I want to say is, if you see something in a trustworthy source, like the New York Times, Washington Post, something like that, trust and verify. Go to the link, look at the reference, look at the article, and just verify it that it says what you think it says, and also check and see if there's already been additional commentary or reaction, because I'm going to use the ibuprofen meme as an example of this. I've gotten several questions just through my friend circle and family about, oh my God, does this mean ibuprofen is going to hurt me? And this all started with the French public health officer recommending not to use ibuprofen or cortisone, but instead to use paracetamol for COVID-19. And this is based on some very, very general recommendations that have nothing to do with COVID-19. And the French minister recommended using acetaminophen or paracetamol, as they call it in Europe, primarily because of reports of when people are very sick and they have comorbidities like heart disease, they're more likely to have a heart attack or an adverse event from their illness if they're using ibuprofen. And there's a couple of reasons for that. One of them is that ibuprofen reverses some of the anticoagulation benefits of aspirin. So if you are, and you might be better off if you have these conditions of taking aspirin and acetaminophen for your thing. And you can take high doses of aspirin and they will still protect your heart, but they will also be pretty good anti-inflammatories. The maximum dose of aspirin that you can take a day is 2,400 milligrams if you have normal kidneys. And that's a lot of aspirin. So that's 12 of the regular strength. You're not going to get there rather that easily, or call it 11 of the regular strength to be more accurate. The symptoms of high of fever and body aches are maybe something that you should actually let happen up to a fever of about 101. And this is just based on old data looking at whether or not treating a low-grade fever helps or hurts your body's immune system's ability to fight a virus. And it might. So when your temp gets above 101, we know that there's no additional benefit. If you start to feel like you're coming down with a cold, my advice to people has always been get warm, take a hot bath. There is data that slows down the progression of most cold viruses. And this COVID-19, while it is much worse than a cold, has overlap with a lot of the cold viruses that would have been studied in these studies. So it certainly won't hurt, and it might in fact help. But the idea that ibuprofen is going to make COVID-19 worse is not supported from the data. And because I read the French literature, I actually went to the article that was the article that he was referencing. And that article was really more a Lancet article about whether, and I'm reading you the title, are patients with hypertension and diabetes at increased risk for COVID-19 infections? That article was purely epidemiological, and it was coming out of China. It was published March 11th, and it was referencing a couple of studies looking at who dies in the ICU from COVID-19. And the answer to that was people with heart disease and cerebrovascular disease and diabetes, hypertension and coronary artery disease. Those are people who have a higher rate of death in the ICU. And there's nothing magic about this. It makes complete sense. The article goes on to suggest that there might be a link between certain hypertension drugs and morbidity, and it raises a theoretical issue. And that's the problem, is that people are raising theoretical issues that may or may not be true and which have no actual external validation. And until they do get external validation, we need to hold it together, not freak out, not set our hair on fire, and understand that because of the rapid cycle time, these articles are going to come out and they're going to be hypothetical, and the news services are going to pick them up as if they are established fact, because the news services are used to trusting the science media. And it's not to say that they're not trustworthy right now, but they are publishing stuff that's speculative that ordinarily would not probably have gotten through the editors. That is our new business as usual. So as I say, you want to fact check stuff and you want to give it some time before you act on it. So in the case of this idea that these blood pressure medications could have something to do with making COVID-19 worse, this is pure speculation. There's no data to suggest it. And there is also some evidence that suggests that these drugs may in fact be protective. This is just true of science, and you've heard it 1,000 times from me, but here it's worth one more time. You can't use logic when you're talking about biology. You just have to wait for data. I'm going to get down now that I've done my sort of big picture thing. Let's move to some small picture stuff, practical advice, the old news you can use thing. And I do want to let you know that I have decided to make telemedicine services available to people outside my normal patient panel. A lot of people are pivoting to telemedicine, and you can request an appointment if you want an initial evaluation via telemedicine. Even if you are not my regular patient, I am going to provide that service. I can be reached at 831-421-0197. And you will get a message, and we will call you back and try to get you on the schedule pronto. I'm offering both phone and if I can make it work with the bandwidth of the internet, as people try to work and educate themselves from home, we will be doing it also on teleconferencing. As I said, I will be posting updates on Twitter, and I am just letting you know that it is at Ask Dr. Dawn, D-R, Dawn. I have posted on my website the text of the advice that I'm about to give you. So this document, or the next few minutes at least, if you miss something, don't worry, because you will be able to access it at AskDrDawn.com. I want to start out with, I think, the thing that's on everybody's mind, testing. And the fact is that we, as a country, as a nation, really messed up on testing. You've probably heard some of the stories about this. Ultimately, I think that we are used to being rugged individualists, and we're used to having the best healthcare epidemiologic service in the world in the form of the CDC. Unfortunately, this time it didn't work out so well. So I have posted on the website a link. It's in this document called Coronavirus COVID-19 Advice. And I've posted a link to a very good podcast that describes exactly what happened. But the Cliff's Note version of this, or executive summary, as the case may be, is that we decided to make our own test. The CDC, that created a delay. The United States government also decided not to authorize states or commercial entities to make their own tests, which would have been fine, except that the CDC test was flawed. So that lost us about 3 weeks. They were authorized to do their own testing after many requests, and when it became obvious that that was what was needed, it was really too late to identify everybody who might have been exposed and quarantine them. That's too bad. It's a missed opportunity that we will grieve later on. At this point, recriminations don't get us anywhere. All of the state labs are flooded. The commercial labs will maybe be able to run 10,000 tests per week nationally. So we are not looking at testing for mild cases or even moderate cases anytime soon. You have to be quite sick to qualify to get a public health test, and those are running a little bit quicker, but they are still not running quick enough to satisfy me, or any single doctor in town could probably be running as many tests as we've been able to run so far in the last couple of weeks since testing became available in this county. So who should be tested? People who are really sick, severely ill, who have pneumonia. Those are the people that they are testing. Hospitalized patients, if people are healthcare personnel who've had close contact with a suspected or a laboratory confirmed case, those people we have to test because we need to take them off of the front lines if they're positive, and we need to know that pronto because we don't need them spreading it. People who have a travel history from an affected area are not automatically getting tested anymore because the yield is too low and it's kind of too late for that situation. So essentially, my best advice to you is stay home. Cook your own food. Stay 6 feet away from people, as that is the distance coughed up. They were saying that that you needed an N95 mask. It was recently switched as of yesterday morning to droplet protection. So now, guess what? Those non-N95 masks probably do provide some protection when you're going out. I've been wearing them from day one. You go and get yourself some if you can. Unfortunately, supplies are really thin. But if you've got some kicking around, use them because they do actually provide some benefit according to the latest health department information. I really cannot emphasize how much you need to stay home. The next thing on the handout is a link, and that is to an article called Coronavirus Act Today, and it explains the flattening of the curve thing and does some mathematical modeling. The flattening of the curve thing was, you can find in the Washington Post. The first article was last week, but the mathematical models here using data gleaned from the data and explaining the delay. So essentially, we're looking at at least as far as China's concerned and what the mathematical modeling shows, for every identified case, there are 1,000 unidentified cases. That's from China. They live very closely. You know, your personal experience may vary, but you need to assume that it's here. You need to assume it's in the public space, and you need to take appropriate steps. So here's some suggestions for keeping yourself safe. We've already covered the social distancing and crowd avoidance. You've heard this. Before we go any further, I want to take a moment talking about crowd avoidance and allude back to something I said in the beginning, which is there are all sorts of ripple effects, and saving a life is a privilege. One of the unintended, unexpected consequences of the shutdown, which is totally appropriate in terms of the shutdown, is that the blood supply is tanking. And that person who was in the truck that rolled over and the person who has a bleeding ulcer, those people are going to need blood. And if the blood supply tanks, so will they. The Red Cross is taking steps to put the beds 6 feet apart. They are making it safe for people to go in and give blood. You want to, if you possibly can, make an appointment with the Red Cross on their website and go in and give blood. This is particularly important if you know yourself to be a rare type. You know, wear a mask, wash your hands. They're going to be using the appropriate sanitizing measures. they already do, but they're majorly ramped up. And we really need people to be heroic at this moment and give blood if they possibly can. And if you do go out, I want you to look down at your feet and think about your shoes. I haven't heard this, but I want to put it out there. When you cough, the germs go onto the floor, right? You cough into the air, the germs drop onto the floor. The floor is now contaminated. And when you go out, I advise that you have a designated pair of outdoor shoes that are going to stay outside when you come home, or if that's not feasible, that you're going to pick up, bring in, and spray down with a bleach solution that I'm about to tell you about. Avoid tracking thing into your house. Your car floor also has germs and will potentially have COVID-19. So even if you drive somewhere and don't get out, I would still clean my shoes off or have, as I said, a pair of outdoor shoes, which is probably easier. Please carry some kind of hand sanitizer. I know hand sanitizer, such as the alcohol gels, has pretty much dried up. Just rubbing alcohol in a little spray bottle will do fine. Pure rubbing alcohol will be great. If you're going out, you know, it can be hard on your hands, so also bring along some lotion or some oil. Use it after you touch door handles, banisters, gas pumps, your credit card. And if you can, use a dry tissue. That will actually act as a shield for COVID. So, for example, after you wash your hands and you're leaving the bathroom, a Kleenex or a piece of toilet paper on the door handle will save you from that. Well, in the case of women, 10% of women who don't wash their hands. In the case of men, oh, it's more like 35 to 40%, according to scientific studies, who don't wash their hands, which is just crazy, but there you go. Hopefully that behavior is improving in the current context. You also need to think about things that are coming in that you're bringing in. Did somebody cough and then pick up the can of pork and beans that you just picked up off the shelf? Maybe. So just wipe things down. As I said, I'll give you the recipe in a moment. You can dip vegetables and salad just for 10 seconds in a dilute bleach solution in a pan, and then just rinse them off until there's no odor. You know, as far as mail's concerned, mail's been handled by a number of humans. You probably want to take the mail out of the envelopes and get rid of the envelopes. Don't put stuff on food surfaces like mail or packages that come into the house until you've decontaminated them. And I use that with quotations. You're reducing your chance of things coming into your home. It's not nothing. None of the things I'm telling you can be assumed to work 100% of the time. So then we let's talk about that bleach solution. You want to take a liter of water and put 4 teaspoons, not tablespoons, 4 teaspoons of bleach in there and mix it up, and that will kill viruses. And it kills them very quickly. So if you're out of Clorox wipes, this is your solution. I find that thyme oil and rosemary oil, if you've got some essential oils around, cover the bleach smell very nicely. And that might be something that you want to add to your spray. All right, next one. Money. Money is dirty. It's porous. It can carry germs. Coins are also a potential vector. We're hearing from CDC that porous surfaces are not, like fabric, are not as bad as hard surfaces. Impermeable surfaces seem to hold the virus for longer. And we're not really sure. I have seen figures from 2 to 9 days. I'm thinking 2 is certainly more likely, and I'm kind of using a 2-day let it sit. For example, I didn't unpack my suitcases for 2 days because they had been transited through Europe, and like I was coming back from Morocco, but we passed through Madrid, so there we are. And your suitcases, the packages that you receive in the mail, all of these things have touched a lot of conveyor belts at this point. And the thing in front of it on the conveyor belt, well, there you go. your credit card, I've already mentioned. So sanitize that. Carry your own pen when you go out if you're going to pay for something. And, you know, it's one of those ones where you put your credit card in and then you have to use their thing to sign. Pull a tissue out. Hold their pen with the tissue and sign your name. If you have to sign a paper form, carry your own pen to avoid touching a surface that maybe have been handled by other people. Your phone needs frequent wiping down, and this is the one exception. Don't use bleach on your phone. That is bad. Use alcohol. Your computer keyboard is contaminated. Clean it regularly, but if you're in a public area or you're not entirely sure, just go wash your hands again. And when you wash your hands, I know you've heard this, but I'm going to reiterate it, sing happy birthday twice, that'll work, or set a clock, a timer, and do it for 20 seconds. And I recommend taking one of those old toothbrushes that everybody's got kicking around in a drawer in case they need to clean something, and keeping it in your pocket. You can obviously chop down the handle a little bit, but that's your instant nail brush. And so clean under your nails, rub your fingers together while you're singing happy birthday, let the soap sit on your hands for 20 seconds, and rinse, and that will do the trick. Think about your car. Think about steering wheel, door handles. When you get into the car from a public space, the question you need to ask is, should I use a tissue to open my car door? Should I use more hand sanitizer or do a spray down on my hands? And the answer is yes. You want to try to keep the inside of that car clean. I also want to talk about travel just briefly. I think it's pretty obvious. Air travel is a substantial issue, and air travel is not something that we can make clean. Just to make you a little bit paranoid, because I think we all need to be a little bit or more than a little bit paranoid, those overhead bins are not cleaned. When they clean an airplane, they don't clean the overhead bins, which means you're putting your suitcase next to other suitcases then going to go home. And this is advice I gave you all like 3 or 4 weeks ago. If you go back and listen to the very first show, and I'll get the date for you, that where I start talking about COVID-19, I know one of the first bits of information I said was sterilize the immediate environment of your airplane seat. And that means wiping down the tray table and the seat belt and the armrests and anything that you're likely to touch during that flight. And that was a lot easier when hand sanitizer was more readily available. But now you're going to just use alcohol, spray it on a tissue, and you're going to do the same darn thing. And you might get a dirty look from the person sitting next to you, but probably not right now. Better to drive. I just today gave my patient the advice that her daughter, who wants to come home because school's shut down and she's, you know, stuck off at a university somewhere with nothing to do, the advice I gave was, yeah, she needs to drive. And yeah, it's going to take 30 hours. And yeah, she should drive because you know where your car's been. But air travel right now, if it's not completely critical, you are taking a risk of getting exposed. And I strongly recommend against it. So don't smoke, right? Don't smoke or vape anything. Your biggest risk here is viral pneumonia, which in COVID-19 doesn't start in the bronchioles. It starts deep in the lungs, down in the air sacs. And one of your first protections, and we'll be talking about innate immunity in a little while, one of your first protections here is the ciliary bladder. That is to say, you've got little cilia that are beating in your bronchioles and a layer of mucus that captures most of the bacteria and viruses that you breathe. You want to sweep that out of your lungs. You do not want to paralyze the cilia, which is exactly what smoking does. Furthermore, and I'm sorry to say this, but marijuana seems to really impair ciliary function or some other aspect of the immune system. So if you feel like you're fighting off a cold, you shouldn't be smoking anything. A switch to edibles if you've got whatever condition where you find that CBD or THC is necessary to you. but don't smoke. Now we're talking about things that help your immune system. Get enough sleep. Meditate. Don't overwork. You can always take some time off right now. That is the one good thing about right now, is that we have leisure time. So don't go online and start becoming a news junkie and get a case of the oh my gods because you're watching CNN and they're just, you know, they want to keep you watching, right? That's how they make their money. You don't need to do that. Give yourself a diet. You know, 15 minutes a day of news is plenty. And that's what you should be doing, is focusing on other things, focusing on things that make you feel peaceful and safe, whether that's a hot bath or a diving into a book or diving into a feel-good movie, whatever it is, do that, because you want to send warm and fuzzy signals to your immune system. Those of you who know how to meditate, those of you who know how to do yoga, breathing, dedicate a half an hour a day, 15 minutes in the morning, 15 minutes at night, and whatever it is that you're doing, you'll know when you've done enough. You'll feel the shift in your body. It's the same shift that you feel after you've had a good meal. It's the same feeling that you feel when you've gotten a hug from someone you love, and or you've had a good conversation with a friend, and you walk away feeling grateful and in love with the universe. That's the feeling you're shooting for, because you know what that does? That revs up your immune system. Or more accurately, fear and adrenaline decrease your immune system. Even good fear, even good adrenaline, like I'm getting married or I'm in a race, these things are shown to decrease the mucosal immunity, which is one of your first lines of defense against COVID-19. Don't let yourself fall into this death spiral of fear and anxiety. Resist, 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 so that you can resist. Eat mushrooms. Eat fermented foods. These stimulate the immune system in a good way. Monitor your temperature. Be concerned if it goes above 101, especially if you have a dry cough. That's the moment when you want to really take a deep breath and realize that this could just be a cold. Remember I said we've tested 40 sick people in this town and 13 have been positive. That means that 2/3 of them were not, despite being quite ill, ill enough to actually fake out the doctors. So mild stuff is mild stuff, and stay home and ride it out unless you become short of breath. And there's no better advice I can give you, because if you succumb to panic and head for the urgent care, your chances of actually exposing yourself is much higher than your chances of getting any significant assistance. All right? If you feel like you can't breathe, that could be anxiety. My advice to you, find some stairs, do 20 jumping jacks. If you can do 20 jumping jacks, you don't have a significant pneumonia. And if 3 wipes you out and puts you on the couch, then that's the time when you want to get out your phone and call 211. A 211 is, God bless them, the United Way has a helpline that is being staffed, so far as I know, nationally. It is certainly active locally. You can also text to 211 COVID-19, no hyphen, and someone will get back to you. It may take a couple of hours, but someone will get back to you, and that is probably the thing to keep in your head, is 211 is going to be a lifeline for all of us. In short, you don't want to need emergency services, hospitalization, and be very careful with fire. Some people I see are still using fire to warm their houses. You might want to rethink that and burn a little energy. The services are stretched thin, and the best civically minded thing you can do is keep those resources available to those that need them. All right, so now talking about the possible, and I want to emphasize possible breakthrough. This is extremely preliminary work, and there are a number of other articles out there suggesting that this is probably not appropriate. We're going to talk about chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine. These are old malaria drugs, actually. They are way old. But in recent years, they have found themselves a place treating, particularly in the case of the hydroxychloroquine, treating autoimmune disease like rheumatoid arthritis. They are what we call disease-modifying agents in the rheumatological world, and they help with the aches and pains and the inflammation. And I think that runaway inflammation is one of the things that that's starting to emerge as a phenomenon that may be taking place. And the question is, well, what do we use for that? Do we use steroids, or does that actually impair the immune system too much? There is some data on the use of chloroquine in viral illnesses, and it is out there on the web also. So we're going to start with chloroquine and COVID-19. This is an abstract of an article, and there have been recent reports that brought attention to the possible benefit of chloroquine. And then they talk about the in vitro activity of chloroquine. And it's very good in vitro. In a petri dish, it's great. It kills Ebola, it kills SARS, kills H1N1. The problem is that when you give it in vivo, that is to say in animals, it actually can make some diseases worse. There's a viral illness called chikungunya that we have no treatment for. Studies have in a non-human primate model, so that's probably macaques or maybe rhesus monkeys. You make things worse, and if you experiment in a petri dish and it looks like it makes it better, and then you experiment in a monkey and it looks like it makes it worse, then you really want to think twice about extrapolation. And that's really what our problem is right now. We have rampant extrapolation going on. It's theorizing, and it's good to have theories, but you know, you don't want to jump to conclusions. We have seen that fail, and it very likely could. Now, that being said, I'm going to talk about a letter that was recently published, and this is in Bioscience Trends, which is not exactly a major journal, but it is, and as I said, it's a letter which has lower standards. What this letter says is that chloroquine phosphate has shown apparent efficacy in treatment of COVID-19 in clinical studies. This is coming out of China, and I am not seeing much in the way of numbers. The results for more than 100 patients superior to control in inhibiting the exacerbation of pneumonia, improving lung imaging findings, and basically they put this out in late February. So there are not good enough studies for everybody to be going and putting themselves on Plaquenil. For one thing, honestly, folks, it's very clear that the vast majority of people will have an annoying illness that's quite contagious, but very survivable. So we're looking at a 1% death rate, and that's still a lot of people if everybody gets it. I'm not trying to minimize it. But your odds of dying your odds against dying are pretty excellent. And we want to save what chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine we have for the people who are hospitalized. We don't want to basically do what happened with the hand gel. And I've already had a couple of people text me asking if I would be willing to write them a Plaquenil prescription. And the answer is, how sick are you? And unless you're quite sick, the answer is no. I want to save that for the people who are, in fact, quite sick. And that's the sort of triage decision that this circumstance forces us to make. We're interested in saving lives, not making people comfortable. Right now, making people comfortable is just not a thing. So we have to focus. I want to keep as many people out of the hospital as possible because I want the doctors in the hospital to have enough ICU beds and enough ventilators that no one has to make the really, really difficult decisions that are being made in Italy right now. I also want to, I'm sorry, burst a balloon. And this is a report that was published, I think, yesterday or the day before. It's very recent in Pediatrics. And this was a pre-publication. It was released. It's been accepted for publication, but it is not the final version. There may be some editing that goes on, but essentially it's gotten through peer review. And it was a study looking at the epidemiology of COVID-19 in children. And I'm just going to break it down for you. Children can still get sick. Children can still die. Don't assume that because it's a child that it's not going to go severe. It's much less frequent. But we still need to be protecting our kids and not assuming they'll be fine because they're kids. In China, at least, they have had deaths. And what the data from this study shows very clearly is that babies are at pretty substantial risk. Now, we think that for influenza, and it's proving to be true for COVID-19. So under 12 months of age, you want to use precautions. And you want to be sure that you don't get cavalier. Infants need to be protected. Older children need to be protected. The death rates are lower. The proportion of severe and critical cases, all right, in this Chinese cohort, here we go, I'm going to give you some numbers. Severe and critical cases, 10% for age under one, 7% for 1 to 5, drops down to 3 to 4% between 6 and 15. And then as you get older, it starts going up again. There's no sexual difference. Boys are not more vulnerable than girls with this particular virus. Children tend to catch it earlier, it looks like, but that may be an artifact. And so you can't really assume that what you read last week is true this week. And that, my friends, is where we'll have to leave it. This is Dr. Dawn saying, as I usually do, so long and stay healthy.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.